You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal. I'm an associate professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. Joining me today is Dr. Ed Song. Ed, you are associate professor of philosophy. Did I get that right?
That is correct.
All right. It's been a while since I've introduced one.
It has been a while.
With you on it.
It's interesting. I
didn't know that. At Westmont College in Santa Barbara, California. Ed, how are you doing?
Well, as I was just saying before we got started, if I can get through this week, then all will be well. But if I can get through this week, things are just crazy right now. But good, like good crazy. And yourself?
Not bad. It is still terribly, terribly hot in rural Missouri, and I'm not enjoying that. But otherwise, the semester is busy, but, you know, fine. No complaints. I do have a question for you, though, and this is something we haven't talked about. Democrat primaries.
Oh.
What do you think about that that zoo?
Yeah, so I confess that I haven't been very plugged in to what's going on. I don't even know if I have seen so much as a minute of any of the debates. And part of that is a function of, as I said earlier, just how busy things are. I have been keeping up on news articles, so we get the Times, and so after every Democratic debate, I will make a point of reading the scuttlebutt afterwards. But yeah, it's been busy. I don't know how many official contenders there are at this point. It just
several hundred.
Yeah. I've been even thinking of throwing my own name in there because, you know, I'm Asian and I like math.
Right. You know a lot of doctors,
I
right?
I do know a lot of doctors. I'm related to several. It's too much to pay attention to. And even more than that, it's anxiety-inducing as I just sort of think about the consequences and the things that are going on. So I will pay attention as we get closer to things. And I like Elizabeth Warren. I think I like Elizabeth Warren a lot more than I like the others. Some of the others I like fine. I mean, I like them all fine, I suppose. But I'm a Warren man.
There is a small part of me that does want the Democratic nominee to be Elizabeth Warren. Like, I want to be done with her at the national level. And that's the best way to
so
do
that.
So that
isn't out of admiration. So, in the way that you had admiration for Bernie Sanders 4 years ago.
No, it is definitely not.
20 seconds on your disdain for Elizabeth Warren?
No. such cannot be crammed into 20 seconds. She is not the worst of the people running, but she is the worst of the people running in the front. So, towards the top. Don't get me wrong, Andrew Yang has a powerful appeal. In the I'm going to write you a check, literally write you a check if you vote for me, as does Marianne Williamson. I mean, how much fun would a Marianne Williamson Donald Trump election be?
Who would you vote for?
Like just to watch? Oh, I don't know. I'd probably have to go down the ticket a ways. At this point, it kind of doesn't matter. But yeah, I don't know. It's been interesting. I've been enjoying watching it just because it is kind of a zoo and I like politics. Mm. So
well,
the circus is always fun.
Yeah, I'm glad you remind me because to a certain degree, I am chastened about a certain responsibility to follow things more closely. And then
at this point, it doesn't matter. No. We're more than a year out.
Well, that's probably true as well. But in any case, you and I should certainly do. We should do a Democratic primary episode. I mean, we're going to end up doing lots of them. And in some ways, I think talking about some of the... It's worth talking about some of the contenders further down the ticket. Like, I think Andrew Yang is actually a really interesting person to talk about.
Sure.
Williamson as well, less because I think she's an interesting candidate or would be a qualified candidate, and more just because what her appeal sort of says about her moment. But I think Yang is a qualified candidate.
I mean, yeah, that's a complicated question. I don't really have a dog in this because the Democratic Party has no interest in my vote. So all of the people who I would be likely to actually vote for didn't make the last debate. They did make the previous one, but they didn't make the last one, and they're unlikely to be allowed into future debates. So,
well, we'll have to talk about that. I mean, now is probably not the time to talk about that. Now I'm super interested in. I disagree when you said that they're not interested in your vote.
I mean, they're interested in my vote, but they're uninterested in, you know, saying the things that would get me to vote for them.
Well, yeah, maybe. Anyways, we'll talk about that soon.
Sure.
I also want to talk about national conservatism sometime soon, which is the other thing that's going on in the Republican Party that I think is really, really interesting. But that, again, future fodder.
Yeah, no, today we should actually get to our book, otherwise we won't get through it, because I think in some ways today is the big day. We're kind of right in the middle of Niebuhr's Christ and Culture, and today we're going to be talking about, make sure I get these in the right order, the Christ of Culture and Christ above Culture. So last time we sort of gave an overview, talked about Christ against Culture, and Niebuhr's argumentation through all of that. Today we start with something that Niebuhr links to Christ against Culture, and then move on to something that Niebuhr sets into a separate category. But Ed, why don't you start us off with the Christ of Culture?
Right. So last time we were together, we briefly mentioned the five typologies that represent the five different ways in which Christians have sought to engage the world. They are meant to be typologies. You find them to greater and lesser degrees in the real world, but they do represent five distinct strategies and styles. The first two, well, the one that we discussed last week, and then the first of which we will discuss this week, represent the extremes of the different types. And then as we start talking about Christ above Culture in a minute, that represents one of the intermediate types in this. But last time it was Christ against Culture, whose attitude is characterized by a stark resistance, drawing a stark line between Jesus, Christianity, everything that stands for. That is the new law. That is a rejection of everything of the world. And now we look at the opposite of that, what Niebuhr calls Christ of Culture, which he also describes as the natural law type, which I think is a little bit misleading for the modern ear, and maybe better the accommodationist type. And so what this model is about is it doesn't see a fundamental conflict between Christ and Culture. Christ becomes assimilated into the dominant intellectual, ethical, social, cultural traditions of the day. So advocates of the Christ of Culture stance feel very comfortable standing with one foot in both camps. There's no deep internal tension in terms of trying to reconcile Christian religious conviction with the dominant outlooks of the day. And so as in every chapter, there's this repeated structure in which Niebuhr starts off giving historical examples of this type. His first example for the Christ of Culture is a little bit surprising in some ways, and that is the Gnostics. The ancient Gnostics represent an example of this. And he specifically mentions Basilides, who I don't think I have heard of, and Valentinus, who I think I have heard of, I think because he's mentioned in the Confessions, Augustine's Confessions a few times in passing.
The Confessions and Irenaeus, I think, both respond to and Valentinianism is an early heresy, so you might have heard of that.
Yeah.
Just overall.
Yeah. Yeah, and because it's a Gnostic, because it's a Gnostic heresy. And so again, the idea of Christ of culture is that it is accommodating Christianity to what is already believed. And so Gnosticism has always been a little bit of a weird view, but it represents the Christ of culture stance insofar as Gnostics already believed in, as it were, this rather intense dualism in which all of the things of the world are fallen, broken, corrupt, and anything good can be found by escaping the world, by rejecting all of the stuff of the world. So the physical, the material, is intrinsically fallen and broken and in need of rejection and escape. And all that is good, true, and beautiful lies in the ideal or in the spiritual. So you have that idea, that kind of Gnostic philosophy, which then runs into Christianity, which at least some Gnostics embrace as being a particularly nice exposition of that basic Gnostic kind of dualism, right?
Right. Christ is the gnosis, right? He is the logos and the culmination of all spiritual life.
Yes. So Jesus comes and shows us or tells us that the body is the soul's tomb. And that real salvation is about escaping from the physical world. Oh, another thing that Christ does, importantly, is that he disentangles all of the weird and corrupt Jewish history and theology from true religion, as it were. And right. So we see in Jesus, or we apparently see in Jesus, the separation between the old law and the new law. And what Jesus really is, he is the cosmic savior of our souls, rescuing us from our bodies and the fallen material world. Right? So Gnosticism is a weird view, and sometimes when we think of it as being a kind of a fringe view, but it represents the Christ of culture mindset insofar as it's accommodating Christian religious belief to what is already believed.
Well, and so because of this division between the spirit and the body, or the soul and the body, whatever happens to the body, whatever culture wants to do is fine. Right? So it's also accommodationist in the sense of just kind of a total, whatever culture is doing, who cares? It doesn't affect what's going on with your soul. Which isn't to say that, you know, you can't have political opinions and maybe those should be informed by whatever the grand revelation is that you have, but at the end of the day, it's irrelevant. So let the Roman government do what it wants to do. Stoic philosophy or whatever reign sovereign in the academies, it doesn't matter. At least in sort of Niebuhr's reading of one of the ways in which it's accommodationist.
Yeah, but the thing that really... it's distinctive here, in some ways, isn't like the content of any particular views, but more like the kind of the stance.
Right.
And so as we'll see in a second, the content of these various different exemplars of the Christ of culture view is like, I mean, they're in stark disagreement, right? The thing that really matters with regard to it was the kind of a stance or attitude about willing to accommodate between Christianity and what people believe in the day, and now what people believe in the day is going to vary wildly from era to era to era.
Sure.
So we move from the ancient Gnostics to Abelard, the French medieval theologian, is another example, according to Niebuhr, of this kind of an attitude. And the content, again, of Abelard's thought is radically different from that of the Gnostics, but both represent the Christ of culture type insofar as they both bend Christian conviction into what is best in their own cultures. So for Abelard, Jesus is the great moral teacher. As Niebuhr says, Jesus is significant to Abelard because he is doing in a higher degree what Socrates and Plato has done before him. So again, starting with these convictions that we already have or are found in the intellectual traditions of our day, and then grabbing Jesus and grabbing Christianity as being an exemplar, a particularly nice exemplar of that. And then equally, Niebuhr mentions John Locke. Thomas Jefferson, in some ways, is one of the most famous examples of this.
Kant also makes an appearance, I think.
Yeah, I was going to get to Kant in a second, but Niebuhr notes that Jefferson says, "I am a Christian in the only sense in which Jesus Christ wished anyone to be." And Jefferson famously sees Jesus as being this great moral teacher, right? But he edits his gospel and takes out all the crazy supernatural stuff, which is an incredibly nice example of the Christ of culture mindset. We're accommodating Christianity to what we already believe, but then we need to sort of excise out any of those bits that conflict with the dominant views of society or culture or ideas, which Jefferson does by literally cutting out those passages of the New Testament or those teachings of Jesus that seem supernatural or unbelievable to this deist enlightenment kind of a mindset. But then Niebuhr, maybe a little bit more relevantly for us, talks about Schleiermacher, talks about Reichel. Then the most relevant example for us, the most familiar example for us of this attitude of Christ of culture is just liberal Protestantism, right? Picking up on this tradition of people like Jefferson and Locke and Mill and others, is happy to embrace the social teaching of Jesus, the concern for the broken and the downtrodden and the disadvantaged, right? Which accommodates nicely with their own kind of the dominant social mores of the 20th century, but comes at the price of wanting to excise all of the supernatural bits which conflict with the modern scientific understanding of the world, the more radical teachings, more personal moral teachings about sin and things like that, right? So for us, the most relevant example of this kind of attitude are the liberal Protestants.
Right, meaning theologically.
Yeah,
liberal,
sorry. Theologically liberal mainline Protestants. I guess, yeah, I count myself as a liberal Protestant in my own way, but not in that sense.
Right.
So we move through these examples, and then as we get in every chapter, we get a defense of the attitude, followed by a kind of a criticism of the attitude. And one of the interesting things in the defense of the Christ of culture attitude is that Niebuhr notes that it's an attitude that's actually almost impossible to avoid. And so he notes that, you know, last time we talked about American fundamentalists as being the example par excellence for the Christ against culture mindset. But Niebuhr notes that they actually exhibit something of the Christ of culture mindset insofar as what they're really doing over and against their modern theologically liberal Protestant antagonists is that they're trying to assimilate Christ to an older culture, as it were, right? So while contemporary American fundamentalists very much now represent the Christ against culture, what that's really rooted in is this understanding of Christianity that's kind of assimilated to an older culture, right?
Yeah, I want to say something about that before we leave this chapter, but okay. We should keep going.
So in some ways, it's an attitude that's almost impossible to avoid. But a little more positively, Niebuhr wants to note that there are values in this particular stance towards the world that are important and that are easily overlooked. And the main idea here is just that this particular model is the model that emphasizes translating the tradition for our times. And that, I mean, for one thing, so people of this type represent important translators of Christianity for our times. And in some ways, like, this kind of translation is essential and necessary. I mean, we cannot think about and make sense of the world in terms any other than the ones that we just get from the world, right? So we're always starting from somewhere. And if Christianity weren't connected to, or if it doesn't exemplify ideas of which we are already familiar, then it would just be wholly alien, other, nonsensical, insane, right?
So foolishness,
what,
even.
I'm sorry, what?
Foolishness, even.
Yeah, yes. I think somebody has once said that before.
I know, right?
Yeah, but you know, but even then, Paul in some ways is the great translator. It does represent, the gospel does represent foolishness to those that are outside of it. But at the same time, Paul is constantly taking pains to explain why it actually ain't foolishness to the Jew, right? Trying to show that in the great Jewish story, Jesus is precisely who was foretold to come, and that he represents the culmination of and the fulfillment of the law, right? Not doesn't stand against it. He's fulfilling it. It's and then equally, you think of Paul as the missionary to the Gentile world, and for example, in Athens at Mars Hill, he demonstrates an incredible understanding of secular Greek philosophy and tries to interpret the claims of the gospel in terms that his Gentile, thoroughly Hellenistic listeners will understand, right? To the Jew, he is a Jew. To the Gentile, he is a Gentile. So it has to connect to something. It can't just come from nowhere. Otherwise, I mean, it wouldn't just be foolishness. It would be indecipherable.
Right. This view should remind us that the gospel is to be relevant in all cultures. Right. It is not disconnected from day-to-day human life, regardless of which culture one happens to find oneself in.
Yeah, but so it's relevant, but not only is it relevant, like, we have to seek to exposit its content by starting with the way in which people apprehend and understand their own world. So Niebuhr writes this: in ancient times, men were attracted by the harmony of the Christian message with the moral and religious philosophy of their best teachers, and by the agreement of Christian conduct with that of their exemplary heroes. Or Christ is always identified with what men conceive to be their finest ideals, their noblest institutions, and their best philosophy, right? So in every culture, in every time, those who would be missionaries to this new culture always connect Christian ideals, Christian teachings, Christian vision of the world and its nature and who Jesus is with the best, with the noblest, most noble institutions or the best philosophy or the finest ideals, finding touch points in culture to connect the claims of the gospel, and then going and talking about how it's opposed to certain aspects of those cultures, right? But it's got to connect to something. So what is attractive and particularly important about the Christ of culture attitude is just the fact that it's always engaging in this translation work. And there is more that I could say there. He says some interesting things about cultural Christians of this style tending to address themselves to the leading groups in a society, that they speak to the cultured among the despisers of religion, and so in that way play a particularly important role in the mission of the church. But Thoughts on that before I move to criticisms?
Yeah, I mean, that's... I don't know that that's speaking in its favor necessarily, but...
Well, I mean, just in the sense, further in the sense that, like, they matter too. So that, you know, that is an interesting kind of a point and a controversial kind of a point, but he's like, they matter too.
Right, right, but it's the... It's not saying that the leaders of society don't matter, it's that the voices to the leaders of society are the people who are largely compromising with the society. Right, it's the Gnostics and it's the theological liberals and it's the and actually that's actually a criticism I have is that he almost exclusively focuses on people who by most metrics would not be considered Orthodox Christians.
Oh yeah,
I think it's better to run with the people who are theologically conservative but take sort of this political approach to culture. If there are such people, I guess.
So sure. I mean, so the big criticism coming, obviously, is just the fact that this kind of attitude leads to the abandonment of a lot of important theological conviction that really matters. But your right. point is that it would be more interesting or more helpful to come up with theologically conservative exemplars of this particular attitude.
Right. So to say that, you know, look at... let's pick the easy target. You know, look at all of the wealthy and powerful politicians that Joel Osteen gets to talk to and try to influence. I mean, that's not a selling point in favor of his worldview from, you know, the historic Christianity perspective.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think the point in this particular... I mean, the point that I was trying to get at and the point in this particular section is... his point is that the conversion to Christianity of the leading groups in a society has been as significant in the mission of the church as the direct conversion of the masses. So there's a little bit of like, those people matter too. And then he goes on, and maybe this is a little bit controversial, but he makes the point that it's the people who are doing this work of the church who are enabled to work for the reformation of the culture, which maybe not everybody's going to think is a good thing. But you know, I take your point, and it's easy to think of exemplars of this particular stance as only being those theologically liberal mainline Protestants when there are...
Or the Gnostics, or... Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, like, they're just... I mean, people like to point out the Gnosticism of contemporary society, and certainly one finds examples of that, but, like, that's not the thing that I'm worried about most. But one can certainly find theologically conservative exemplars of the model, which I think...
Oh, sure. I mean, this is the moral majority.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
This is,
and,
this
and,
is the...
You know, one important thing to note is that the book was originally written in 1951. That was well before the
right.
rise of that particular social, cultural, and political movement, which is so important for us now. But, like, that's the perfect example, right? They're accommodating to this understanding of Christianity that sort of sits surprisingly nicely with kind of this civil religion of America as a Christian nation.
Right. Yeah, and so it's, yeah, it's, I think it's easier to grapple with this position when you've got sort of both sides aiming at the same thing. But anyway, we should do the objections.
Yeah, and now the objections are pretty obvious, and we've both kind of mentioned them, is that in accommodating Christianity to culture, you often have to chip off the hard edges of Christian conviction that don't just fit with the culture. So it leads to the abandonment of, you know, of important aspects of Orthodox traditional Christian religious conviction.
Right, and he points out they like the Christ of culture people tend to ignore things like original sin.
Yeah.
Right. Once you pick something and say, well, this is how it should be, you've left off both the problem and the potential solution to the problem since you've ignored the problem. Yeah, and I mean, there's not a whole lot of orthodoxy that doesn't get left off, I suppose, when this is the perspective, which is actually why I think this is actually the one to sort of focus on and think about and reflect on, because any objection to the Christ of culture position is of necessity going to also be an objection to the Christ against culture position, and then to the last one, the Christ transforming culture position. So I mean, this is sort of the capstone of the first and the last in this book, because this is the one that those two are both aiming at. So any criticism that can be made here will eventually be able to be made in either of those also.
Mm-hmm.
Which I mean, we can talk more about that, I guess, when we get to the last one also. But it is something to something to keep in mind. If this is wrong, then the other two, if they are successful, are also wrong.
Wait, so the other two being against and transforming.
Right.
I'm not sure if I see that. So I thought the point that you were making about those other two are both kind of rooted in objections to the Christ of culture view.
No, my point is the goal, the end game of the other two is to create a culture which Christ is the Christ of.
Yeah, so I don't know if I see that. I mean, that's certainly not the case with Christ against culture, at least in its stated.
Oh, it is. It's a subculture, right? It's a withdrawn culture, but the goal is we will step back from the mainstream culture and create our own little culture which.
Okay, I see what you're saying. Sure. I guess one thing that you can't just obey, there can't be Christ of no culture, right?
No, we have two other options that we haven't gotten to yet.
Oh, sure, okay.
If we're taking Niebuhr's model, I think there's some pretty serious problems with Niebuhr's modeling, but if we're going with his model, if this one is wrong, then this also knocks out two of the other ones.
Okay, sure. And so do you have specific worries beyond what we've already talked about? You mentioned something earlier about wanting to get to something before we left this section.
Yeah, that was what I wanted to get
into. Oh, that's what you wanted, okay.
If this one falls over, it takes down, you know, three-fifths of the options.
Just because 1 and 5 are both aligned to the sanctification of some culture or other.
Right, their goal is the pursuit of what's described in this chapter. A culture to which Christianity can be accommodated in good conscience, whether on a small scale with the withdrawers or on the larger scale with the transformers. Huh, the transformers.
Robots in disguise.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, well, it'll be interesting to see what you have to say then about the other two and the last one. So with that said, why don't you walk us to the third of the types, the first intermediate type, the Christ above culture type.
Yeah, so Niebuhr then, in the Christ above culture, gives sort of an introduction to the last three types, where he points out that for those types, for these remaining types, the real divide is not ultimately between Christ and culture, it's between God and man, and that allows these last three to say something to the effect of, you know, Christ is sovereign over all of life, including culture, which helps account for both the universality and the radical nature of sin, and for grace and the dominance of grace over human works like culture. The real differences, he thinks, between these three remaining ones are how the balance between culture and Christ, or you know, grace and human works, or sin and grace, or whatever, how that balance is going to be struck. And then the first of those that he talks about is the Christ above culture, or what he calls the synthesis of Christ and culture. So these folks refuse to accommodate or to withdraw. So there's a rejection of those first two models. They refuse to accommodate Christ to culture. They refuse to withdraw from culture. Instead, they acknowledge the claims and even the legitimate claims of both Christ and culture. So, you know, we are to render unto Caesar things that are Caesar's and render unto God things that are God's.
I feel like I've heard that somewhere before.
I know, right?
I just can't
it's a good line. So, and then as always is the case, he gives types, right? Exemplars. So Clement of Alexandria is the early church type here, who argues that, I guess what we might call culture rightly understood, and Christ are really two sides of the same coin. Right, the virtues of the best of society largely align with the life that that Christians are called to live. So the culture in this sense can be, but is not necessarily, and not every part of culture is a stepping stone sort of into heaven. So that's not to say that every part of culture is good. It's not just a sort of baptism of all of culture the way the Christ of culture people would do, and it's not to it's not to say that that you're automatically sort of prepping for heaven by living well in the culture, but it's to say that there is good in culture, and that good can be recognized, and that good can even help you see something of the truth of the good of the gospel. And then the great medieval example of this is Thomas Aquinas. Niebuhr says, and I think probably rightly, that that Aquinas is the greatest of these guys. He is the voice of the great medieval synthesis, which of course was not without its tensions. But in this synthesis, nature, culture, and revelation are three ways that God reveals His truth. So nature shows us that we need to be asking questions kind of rationally about teleology. You know, what are we moving towards? What are we living for? And gives us the answer that we should be living for the universal good. And we can find that whether we're living the life of action or the life of contemplation. Culture shows us the way, shows us, it points us to God, but it doesn't allow us to achieve that universal good. It doesn't allow us to be reconciled to God. Only the grace of God, only what comes through revelation does that. But what we see in this sort of structure is that there's a civic virtue and a Christian virtue. And there are two roads that go the same way. They crisscross each other. They're intertwined at times. Maybe sometimes the civic virtue road looks like it's going a different direction, but ultimately they're both governed by grace. And then, you know, for Aquinas, law and justice are going to fall under that civic virtue road, as will economics and politics. You know, the culture is all going to be in that civic virtue road. The church is going to kind of stand astride both roads, although again, these roads are so twisted and tangled together that it can be hard to see that. And then he sort of mentions in passing other synthesists. He doesn't really give them the same amount of time as he had some other modern ones. So Leo the 13th, Joseph Butler, who I admit I had never heard of before I read this, and Roger Williams, who I had heard of, but who I'm not completely sure I agree with what he's saying here. That's the overview. Before I get to the strengths and weaknesses, did I miss anything there? Anything you want to add?
No, that's about right. Sounds fine to me.
Yeah. So the pros of the synthetic approach, it appeals to the whole person. Right, it recognizes both the good in the world and the need for something more. It also gives believers a way in which we can work with non-believers while still maintaining the distinction between us, without having to say, "Yeah, we're really all going to heaven," or mm-hmm. "You know, we're all good people, and that's what counts."
It's common grace in some ways.
It is. It is. Although it's sort of a common grace on steroids, right? And Niebuhr says it has the benefit of being a true position. It's just not the whole truth, and taken wrongly, it can lead to an error. He thinks it confuses the transcendent and the immanent, and it has the habit of elevating culture. And now we're into the weaknesses. It elevates culture beyond what's appropriate, even to the point where it's equal to revelation. And then that once you've made that step, once you've said, yeah, the civic virtue available to me as an American in the 21st century is going the same direction that my Christian virtue is going. Once I've made that step, I have kind of immediately become provincial, right? I've associated something that's true of my kind of chronological moment in history with an absolute and eternal truth. I'm starting to defend a passing culture too much, while I'm simultaneously reducing the gospel to a present institution, and then I'm also trying to speak authoritatively about my culture in a way that we can't actually do that, right? I have revelation about what the Christian life looks like. I don't have revelation about what American civic virtue looks like. I don't have the certain knowledge that civic virtue in my culture is in fact moving the same direction as my Christian virtue. And of course, that there's still that question of the place of sin. It's not, Niebuhr thinks, sufficiently worked out. It's not really sufficiently reflected on. And that is Christ above culture. Ed, what'd you think of this one? I'm sort of curious what your thoughts were.
Yeah. I'm still trying to wrestle with the way that you unpacked part of the view. So the worry is. What's the worry about American civic culture? Like, you're not sure that it's trending in exactly the same direction as your vision of Christian virtue?
Well, it might be, but as soon as I say that it is, I've made a theological statement about American civic virtue. And it has kind of the twofold problem of, first of all, I don't have revelation about that, right? I have not, regardless of what the talking heads on the left or right say, I have not been directly told by God that I must vote for the Republicans or the Democrats in the upcoming election, right? But as soon as I start thinking that way, as soon as I start assuming religious, a religious direction to my vote, I run the risk of elevating my vote to the level of, say, kindness, right, which is a command, or generosity, or mm-hmm. any of the other fruits of the Spirit. That's one problem. And then the other problem is, once I start saying, well, voting Democrat in America in the 21st century, once I work that kind of systematically into my philosophy and into my theology, all I've done is I've taken something that's maybe true right now, or maybe not true, but maybe true right now, and turned that into a system that is deeply provincial, because, of course, it's not going to apply 100 years from now.
Oh, sure. But then you just kind of fallen into the error of Christ of culture, haven't you?
Also true, although, I think that's fair. It might be that a significant portion of this can be folded into the Christ of culture position. That's certainly possible. I think it doesn't go quite that far with most of the thinkers, but I would say that's a legitimate criticism of Aquinas, for example.
How do you mean?
That he wanders maybe a little closer to the Christ of culture position than ought to be.
Yeah, I mean, so in a certain kind of way, something like this picture has to be right. I mean, the thing that you're worried about is uncritically ossifying particular kinds of claims of culture as being expressions of gospel ideas and clinging to that for, like, all times and all places. That's what you're worried about.
Right.
Yeah.
So taking virtues that we value now, and saying, "Hey, these are part of this civic virtue road."
Sorry, I'm this connects in some ways to a lot of things that I've been, or a few things that I've been thinking about, but are still really inchoate ideas.
Sure. Yeah. Same here.
There's a way in which I'm gonna put a point in a particular kind of a way, and then you can tell me if this is what you were getting at or not. I've been thinking about the way in which being a Christian is really, really, really deeply socially contextual in a way, in that the way that the gospel looks and is lived down is very dependent upon our social context. And then maybe there's a danger a little bit and seeing one aspect of our social context and then just kind of confusing that for what gospel is. Again, that's just to fall into the, that's a little bit to fall into the Christ of culture. But then it isn't really a problem of modifying the view. It's just the fact that you get caught up in your the particular cultural frameworks of understanding the world just come to shape the way that we look at Christian belief. Then I was going to say one more thing. But you know, but you're not saying this. You're not saying that, like, it's never the case that matters, cultural issues don't have, like, important gospel import, right?
Oh, sure.
So
sure.
If you and I, you know, okay, so it isn't this really clear theological issue that we could just read out of the Bible that we should vote for this candidate or that candidate in the upcoming election, say.
Right. Right?
But, like, you know, if you and I, you know, we're living in Nazi Germany.
Sure.
We wouldn't say the same thing, right?
Wait, say that again?
If you and I were living in Nazi Germany, we wouldn't say the same thing of, well, you know, I don't know. I don't think that there's really a Christian answer to this political question right now.
Right. And it's interesting that Niebuhr doesn't deal with either that or with totalitarianism in general, right? So writing in the 50s, mm-hmm. If you're living in the Soviet Union and you're a believer, what on earth does Christ above culture mean? And I think this is one of the reasons where I'm somewhat sympathetic to this with any government. Right, any government at anywhere, anytime, in any place, there is going to be truth to this view, right? So yes, if we're living in Nazi Germany or Soviet Russia or Maoist China or whatever, there are going to be horrendous things going on that any Christian of good conscience, assuming they know about these, should oppose. There are also going to be things that the government is doing that are perfectly good and acceptable things for the government to be doing. And that's going to be the case anywhere. So the Christ above culture, I think is a way to account for that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a way to say, yeah, look, you live in Nazi Germany, you should resist, you know, the rounding up of the Jews, and you should resist the erosion of rule of law, and you should resist all of those sorts of things, but part of your resistance doesn't mean you get to just go whatever speed you want on the Autobahn, because everyone knows that the Nazi government's illegitimate anyway.
That's a bad example, because, like, there are no speed limits on the Autobahn, aren't there?
Well, whatever the speed limit was in, 1940, if there was such a speed limit, right?
Yeah, but you can't just flout the laws. That's your point.
Right, so there's still a recognition that, yeah, look, and that's where that culture rightly understood thing comes in, right, of way back from Clement of Alexandria. The best aspects of the culture are things that Christians can look at and say, yeah, these are actually good things. And every government is going to have that, right? Every government, the worst government on earth is going to have some things that it's doing that it should be doing, and it's going to be doing them well.
Well, yeah, more or less, let's say. But
I mean, it's... I don't know of an exception to that, which isn't to say that these governments that do awful things aren't also doing awful things. That's actually one of the objections I would have is there's not a Aquinas and Clement and Niebuhr, at least in his criticisms, they avoid those extreme cases where what do you do when you're in the totalitarian nation? Right. What do you do when it seems that the awful things they're doing are so awful that the good things that governments are doing are reduced to irrelevance and by point of contrast?
Mm-hmm. I'm just kind of thinking about what you said earlier about the first two models and the last model, and whether an argument for an argument against the second brings down all three, and how we make sense of our relationship to culture. And I think a lot of the problems here just come from the slipperiness of what culture means.
Sure.
I think in this context, when we're talking about culture, what we mean is like the dominant social, intellectual, moral framework of the day, like what right. most people believe, right? And then obviously, depending on what your culture is, there is, you know, our attitude towards that culture is just going to vary a lot because the content of those cultures is going to vary a lot, right?
Right.
But there's like no escaping being a part of a culture. Like there, you can't excise yourself and bring yourself out of a culture. Even the Gnostics, right? That's kind of what's interesting about that point that Niebuhr makes about the Christ against culture, also kind of being an example of the Christ of culture, right? Even the Christ against culture are aiming at preserving and being a part of a particular kind of a culture, just a different culture.
Right.
And so we're always going to find ourselves as being a part of living in these frameworks and then of using these frameworks to make sense of what it means to be a Christian, right? Like there's no view from nowhere. There's no unmediated way of understanding the gospel. We read the gospel in language and those words have meanings that we, you know, And we make sense of it using the frameworks that we've inherited, and like, there's just no other way, right? And again, some of those frameworks are going to be better than others, but we're always going to understand the gospel in the frameworks that we're in.
Right, and again, it's a question of is the framework a part of the problem of sin, or is a sort of fundamentally, or is the framework something that is sort of inherently on the side of Christ, or is there somehow both of those things, right? I mean, those are sort of the three options.
Yeah, I guess I'm suggesting, here, let me unpack this, and you can tell me whether or not you think this is one of the three options. But like, even Adam and Eve, in an unfallen state, understood God through the lenses of a particular culture.
I mean, maybe, I don't know. I'm willing to put a question mark there because once you start talking unfallen man, I mean, especially if you're talking just Adam, you know, was Adam in a culture pre-Eve? I mean, I don't know that there is any way to answer that question.
I think the answer to that question is pretty obviously yes. I mean, it depends on what you mean by culture.
Yeah.
Did he speak a language?
I'd assume so. He,
I mean,
spoken
he
was spoken to
without a language.
Right. He's, so he spoken, you know, was spoken then, to.
Insofar as he spoke a language, that language is going to enable understanding particular kinds of thoughts. And
sure.
Right. There's the whole thing about how, I don't know, like Inuit Native American people have like seven different words for snow or whatever, which
right.
is super misleading in some ways because like we just have the one English word snow, but that word can be modified in a variety of different ways. But you know what I mean? It's just sort of like that the language, the words that we have enable us to grasp onto certain concepts in particular kinds of ways. That's kind of what I mean. So there's just no escaping that. And depending
sure.
on the culture that we bring, that's going to enable the understanding of certain kinds of ideas and make it difficult in some ways to understand other kinds of ideas. But
I mean, I don't disagree with any of that. It again, it also doesn't speak to the question of whether culture is part of the thing from which we are saved, or culture is part of the thing that saves us, or some combination thereof.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so, again, it kind of depends on what you mean by culture. Like, do you mean this, the dominant social, intellectual, moral framework of our day? And then it's like, that can obviously be better or worse. Or do you mean by it something a little bit more general, like the inescapable, like, yeah, I mean, you have to have some culture or other, you know?
Right. And I think it's pretty clearly that most of the time we're talking about the former, right? Part of being saved is not being saved from using words.
Yes.
So it's, you know, clearly we are talking about cultures, right, in the sense of the, like you said, the dominant moral view of the day, or the dominant, you know, artistic institutions, or the dominant, again, whatever specific culture we happen to be talking about that then shares these characteristics, although in different ways, with other cultures.
Yeah. Well, that's all I have.
Yeah.
That rather inchoate thought about thinking about the nature of culture.
But no, and it's something I'm still, I mean, I'm not necessarily thinking through the nature of culture, but the relationship between the two is something I'm still thinking about. And I think this Christ above culture is kind of interesting. I think I would want to make a couple of modifications to it, particularly if you're talking specifically about either Clement or Aquinas, then definitely some modifications. I don't know that either of them has a robust enough view of sin, but that doesn't, you know, negate a lot of what they say either. Like, it doesn't mean that what they're saying isn't in some way true. So, yeah. Anything else to add on either of these chapters? Otherwise, we'll just kind of let things trail off there, because we have two more chapters to go.
Yeah, and we will come back to these issues when we get to the end and have everything under our belt.
No, yeah, we may have to do an extra episode, just because I don't know if we're going to be able to. So we have two more chapters, and then there's a postscript, but I think we might also be worthwhile to take an episode afterwards and sort of recap everything.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
So, all right. Well, thank you, listeners, for tuning in. City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippic. Please check out other podcasts in our family. Get more information about our own show or our show notes by visiting christianhumanist.org. Please do leave us a review on iTunes to help other people find our show. Like our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast, or send us an email at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. Ed, I assume you're checking that email, because I have not been.
You know, occasionally. I'll check it right now.
Yeah, okay. Someone might eventually someday check that email, and then we'll do an episode. We have episode 100 coming up, so maybe we'll open our email account. Don't check it now. Let's wait until episode 100, and that our episode will just be us going through the email.
Okay.
I don't know if that would be a good episode or not,
yeah.
But it might be fun. Anyway, this is Coyle Neal, and on behalf of Edward Song, let me remind you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway.